Super Bowls need taglines.
Like a movie poster?
Super LI colon. Ice.
Super Bowl LI.
Fire versus ice.
Who's fire?
It would have to be the Patriots.
Brady?
Because Matty Ice is...
Yeah.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower, he's a playmaker, and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got keyboard, he shattered the mold, and all he does is win, all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, Neil Statman Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
How are you feeling this week, Neil?
Feeling, you know, excited about that week between the conference championships and the Super Bowl. Always really exciting. You got the Pro Bowl. You've got various other sporting events that suddenly see like a little window in which they can jump in and try to capture attention. That's it's very exciting for them.
And you're not sick anymore?
No, I'm okay. Well, I didn't know if you were asking just how am I feeling
your
in general.
Your outlook on the sporting landscape?
Yeah. No, but I feel better physically also.
Okay, good.
But
you were
mainly
sick last
spiritually
week.
In the sports sense.
A lack of football renews you.
Possibly.
Okay.
Although the Super Bowl, and we'll talk about it later, but it should be fun.
I agree.
That's my hot prediction.
That other voice you hear is ESPNW columnist and senior market analyst for Hot Takedown Celebrity.
Yes.
Kate Fagan. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
We were talking before the show about the nature of celebrity in the modern age.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some thoughts, which we don't have
thoughts
to share on the podcast. But
no, those won't be shared. The things that you want to hear, like
that's
like
Kate's idea of a good celebrity.
That's true.
Or a successful celebrity is someone who withholds.
Always
should we get into this? Should we get into this?
All right.
I'm like the Pope, apparently.
Well, that you put it that way, not me. On today's show, we're going to talk about football, the weekend of football that was. I think we'll probably save our Super Bowl preview for next week, but we will talk about how the Falcons beat the Packers and how the Patriots steamrolled the Steelers. And then the Hot Takedown legend, Lexi Brown, the Duke guard, will be on the show to talk about her free throw streak, about Duke's curse in women's college basketball, why they can't perform at the same level of the men as far as the tournament goes. And then also we'll talk to her about how she's feeling about UConn now that they've got this streak that never seems to end. What's it like for a player to look up at UConn and wonder how they're going to take them down?
That they're fighting for second?
I didn't say that. Again, you're putting words in my mouth, Kate.
Again?
You're the Pope.
Oh, I see.
And then finally, the Philadelphia 76ers are back. We say they're back. They're on a rampage.
Cool your Jets, Chad.
Sure. Rampage through the league. They've won the number of games that
they're
many teams win.
They're 15-27.
And so we'll talk about whether this is a harbinger of things to come for the Sixers in this season or in future seasons, and how you know when a talent like Joel Embiid is for real or not. And then our significant digit. There's lots of competition, so I'm not going to get into it. But guys, it might feature dead fish.
We landed on a good sig dig.
Yeah, I'm feeling good about it. All right, to football, where the Atlanta Falcons beat the Green Bay Packers 44-21 on Sunday. Let's start there, then we'll do the Patriots-Steelers game. Neil, as I was watching, I thought, you know, I haven't watched a lot of Falcons games this year, and this Matt Ryan guy was what we saw on Sunday any different than what he's been doing all season? And does it suggest something about how we should reappraise Matt Ryan's legacy is the wrong word, but just sort of his status in the league?
Okay, so this was probably Matt Ryan's best game of the season. He had a 139.4 quarterback rating. If you like ESPN's newfangled stat QBR, he got 98.4 out of 100 on that 100-point scale that stat has. So it was pretty much like a near-perfect game that he threw. But if you look at his numbers for this season, just overall during the regular season, there's a reason that he's the front runner for the MVP, because he had one of the best passing seasons in the history of the NFL. And I think not a lot of people paid as much attention to it as if it had come from someone like, you know, Tom Brady or even an Aaron Rodgers. For instance, he had the fifth highest passer rating in a single season of all time. He also ranked among the top seasons of all time in adjusted yards per attempt, all of these efficiency statistics. So we kind of under the radar in some ways, which sounds crazy, especially given the way that quarterbacks have been elevated in the modern NFL, we sort of saw one of the greatest passing seasons, quarterback seasons of all time. And I feel like just now, after this kind of big game against the Packers, are people sort of being like, oh, hey, yeah, Matt Ryan is actually a great quarterback, when it was kind of, it's been evident, like, his whole career he's been good. And this season he sort of took it to a level that very few have ever had in NFL history.
And still, there to me, there's a general consensus of yawn when it comes to Matt Ryan. And let me drag us into non-analytic territory. Here's where it's non-analytic. I'm trying to come up with a comp for Matt Ryan in quarterback historical terms. And by that, I mean a quarterback who's performing at the highest level, is going to the Super Bowl, seems to have he seems to have everything we kind of want in a quarterback, and yet he doesn't inspire a ton of curiosity among a casual NFL fan. Sure, if you're in Atlanta, you're like, Matt Ryan's great. But otherwise, I think generally speaking, it's hard. I'm trying hard to find a comp for him.
So what's interesting is, do quarterbacks inspire curiosity before they win? So Peyton Manning, also a very boring person, other than his weird OCD-ness and the audibles at the line, I would argue.
Right.
But once you win, you get the TV deals where you get to do the commercials. Aaron Rodgers gets to do the double check. He's got a brother who goes on The Bachelor, et cetera. All of those details matter a little more after you win, when the orbit of mystery and the orbit of curiosity, I think, expands for a quarterback.
Yeah, and I think somebody like Drew Brees might be an interesting comparison there, because I didn't see Drew Brees on a lot of national TV commercials until he won the Super Bowl after the 2009 season, and then you saw a lot of Drew Brees after that. Now, Brees, of course,
and now he's kind of back to not having that many.
A little bit, yeah, since the Saints have kind of gone backward. Through, I should point out, no fault of his own, his passing numbers have been pretty much the same over the past couple years as they were when he was at his peak. It's just that Saints defense is a garbage fire. And so the same could be said about Matt Ryan. I think he's a little bit not as good as Drew Brees, but I think you see this a lot with quarterback. You know, Boomer Esiason, someone else who kind of went to a Super Bowl and that kind of elevated him. But then when he wasn't winning, despite great numbers, and as an example of someone who never really broke through, just looking at the comparable quarterback list to Matt Ryan at ProFootballReference.com, Mark Brunell might be someone that really never got a high profile despite winning a lot of football games, upsetting the Broncos memorably in 1996. He never went to the Super Bowl as a starter, at least, and had great numbers, and so he never really got kind of the due that I think someone of his stature should have gotten. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you and I talked about this, Chad, during the game, somebody like Joe Flacco, who perhaps doesn't have, you know, the great resume outside of that one memorable playoff run. He does have national, you know, name recognition.
He's an elite quarterback.
And he's an elite quarterback, or at least people ask the question about him. And it does kind of show that the situation you land in, and some of it has to do with market size and fan enthusiasm in Atlanta, traditionally, you know, not being one of the marquee franchises in the league. And some of it has to do with just the teammates that you have and whether you get land with a good defense and can kind of work with that.
Well, part of Joe Flacco still flying below the radar, I think. I mean, I know we talk about him being a elite quarterback, but I can't necessarily think for the mainstream sports fan, Joe Flacco's image is going to pop in your mind the same way that a number of other quarterbacks, like we've mentioned, Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. Maybe perhaps part of that is because Baltimore's Super Bowl wins are predominantly predicated on defense, whereas that's why I think Matt Ryan is going to be a curious case if the Falcons do win the Super Bowl, because it will be because of his quarterback play and because of that offense. And so I will be interested to see if after the Super Bowl and those 6 months after, like, do we see Matt Ryan on Saturday Night Live? do we see him in commercials? Because right now, I know nothing about his personality.
Matty Ice, that's all I know.
Right, and I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. Is he supposed to be really good, really good at the end of games? He's great on the two-minute drill?
And possibly he just speaks to boringness. Like, if you've got right. that low level of excitement or whatever. But another interesting thought is that his season this year, Matt Ryan's, is pretty similar to the one that Kurt Warner had in 1999 when he led the Rams out of nowhere to a Super Bowl. And it's kind of an interesting thought experiment. Kurt Warner literally had no track record before that particular season. He was a little bit younger than Matt Ryan is now. But he came out of nowhere. Matt Ryan has this long track record, but it's not a track record that is above the radar, like you said, Kate, for a national audience. And so Kurt Warner had the interesting story of sort of going from grocery bagger to Super Bowl quarterback, and that in and of itself provided a very interesting narrative. But it is kind of interesting how we can kind of find more interest in a quarterback that had really no career record going into their kind of big breakout, great passing season, Super Bowl season, and then he parlayed that into a Hall of Fame or near Hall of Fame career from that point onward. It'd be interesting to see if Matt Ryan, if this is kind of the launching point, or if we could find any other example of a quarterback who was kind of pretty good up to age 31 or 30 and then ended up taking off and becoming this like next level type of, you know, Brady-esque passer.
If they had 3 to 4 years, the Atlanta Falcons did, and that's not absurd to say considering Julio Jones and the offense they have around him is not, they're not in their
young running back or young linebacker and defense.
Is there any then historical, like, obviously I know you won't know this off the top of your head, but I wonder if it would be any historical comp, because every other guy
John Elway didn't win until the end.
But he
good
went to Super Bowl.
He went to Super Bowl.
He famously lost
the
Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, I also have another question about this game.
Yes.
Because the Green Bay Packers, the Falcons at this point haven't been tested in the postseason. And the Green Bay Packers, it reminded me of the discussion we always have about ELO rating for a team leading into a season. Often the previous year matters, and what we've seen from them all year matters, not just the fact that the Green Bay Packers looked really good in the first 2 weeks of the postseason. So what did we get on Sunday? Did we get the Green Bay Packers who made mistakes and were subpar, or was that actually the Green Bay Packers?
I mean, there were a lot of 50-50 balls, or as they say, that didn't quite end up in the Packers' arms.
They were unlucky, quote-unquote. Yeah. They dropped a couple interceptions.
Now, if they get all those, then they're lucky in some ways. Right. You know, you can spin it both ways, but it did seem as though there were a couple moments in which the game could tilt more in the Packers' favor. I'm not sure, away from the control of the Falcons, but it did seem at the end that the 23-point gap between them suggested that the Falcons were really better no matter how many of those 50-50 balls go their way.
And I think you can say this also about the Steelers, but certainly the Packers, where Aaron Rodgers didn't have a horrible game, and the offense for the Packers was not, you know, that terrible, especially relative to some of the stuff that we saw from them early in the season or at midseason. It just was this defense that we had talked about kind of all playoff long that had really improved itself dramatically from that low point where Aaron Rodgers kind of guaranteed that they would run the table. This was the Packers basically reverting back to that same defense that they had against Washington in that blowout and at various low points during the season. So and then the Steelers offense also didn't play particularly terribly against the Patriots, but their defense played poorly, even relative to what you would expect from a team like the Patriots. So I think this was the case of just two overwhelming offensive teams just kind of coming in and dominating teams that perhaps weren't really all that good defensively if you look at the whole season, but had maybe stepped it up a little bit to get to where they were, and then everything just sort of fell apart in the conference championship game.
Neil, thank you for segueing into the Patriots and Steelers game. So
there was another game played this
week. The Patriots beat the Steelers 36-17. It was a little bit closer at times. I think the first half was closer than the second half, and certainly closer than the Falcons Packers game. I don't have much to say about the Steelers, so I was going to bring us to Bill Belichick and his coaching accomplishment, but I'm curious if you guys want to dwell on Le'Veon Bell or anything like that.
The one aspect of that Steelers-Patriots game that I kept thinking about watching was a conversation I had with Ryan Clark, who used to play for the Steelers earlier in the year. It might have even been last year. And he was talking about how they were constantly, when he was with the Steelers, when they would play the Patriots, trying to find a defensive scheme that would work. And they just never could. They were like, all right, we're going to run a 4-3. We're going to run a zone. We're going to run man. We're going to man up. And it's like everything that they did, eventually the Patriots found and really broke open a game against them. And I think that this happens in sports. There's certain teams that just cannot match up with other teams. I mean, I know when I played, I hated playing Iowa State because they ran this 3-2 zone that just left no openings on the perimeter. So for me personally, I hated it. And as a team, we didn't play well against it. And so watching the Patriots and the Steelers, I mean, and then you look at the numbers that are backing it up. Tom Brady against Mike Tomlin and company, he has 22 TDs and zero interceptions. Whew. And you're like, is that a run of luck, or is it that the way that Tomlin coaches his defense is just not a good matchup?
Which
for the,
is funny because usually
Steelers.
You go and chase, you build your team around defeating the team that you are most likely to have to face,
and that is the Patriots.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I would imagine Brady has similar stat, maybe not quite that good against like many teams that he's played
but
a lot
not
of times
as,
over the
as
years.
But not as good as the Pittsburgh
but
Steelers?
But right, you would expect the Steelers to, you know, kind of offer more resistance than the average team, for sure. Now, some of it, I think, also is that the Steelers have this reputation for being a great defensive team, and that hasn't actually been true for the past few years. That, you know, I don't know if it was Dick LeBeau leaving or what it was, but the Steelers once upon a time were, you know, the best or one of the best defensive teams in the league, and they've been more kind of an average defense the past couple years. And so, you know, Brady, maybe it isn't as surprising that Brady, who could be, you know, certainly I think is the second best QB of all time statistically, if we look at it, like Manning, you know, his numbers are so crazy that, you know, Brady probably hasn't passed him yet, at least in a statistical way. But, you know, he's probably ensconced himself as the second best QB ever at a minimum. You know, you'd expect him to feast on kind of a meh defense.
So let's talk about Belichick for a second. 538 is going to have a lot to say about Belichick and Brady and who's successful.
You guys going to answer the question of who made who?
I can't guarantee anything, Kate, but the assignment is out.
To get to the bottom of this chicken or the egg situation?
We have our people looking into it.
You have your people on it?
Yes.
What's the early word?
The early word.
I don't know if there is an early word.
Oh, there's an early word.
There's some early words. Okay.
That is Belichick.
Yeah.
And that if you look at Garoppolo and at Castle – and, you know, there's evidence that the Patriots can perform even without Tom Brady.
But do you think that Bill Belichick developed this flexible blueprint based on, like, data that Tom Brady offered him?
Oh, because he was good in these ways, then Belichick made the team in those ways, you mean?
Yeah, I think that you've got evidence of Bill Belichick being an inferior coach with the Cleveland Browns in terms of record. You've got evidence.
And with the Jets. Those 6 days right. They weren't very good.
They weren't good. And then you've got evidence of Patriots proteges, coaching proteges, going elsewhere without Tom Brady and failing. So they have the blueprint elsewhere. And I'm wondering if really you can't unwind the intertwining of these two because Bill Belichick perhaps developed a blueprint based on what Tom Brady was offering.
We will give you an early readout of this piece. You can offer a rebuttal. I don't know.
I have no analysis to bring to this.
You can judge Belichick and Brady based on whether the assistant coaches were successful.
I don't think so either. I mean, it has been a long-standing theory of mine without analytics that Tom Brady, if and I asked you to do that data on if you played his career over and over again,
right.
Does he always? How many Super Bowls does he win on average? How many? And I'm like, in a lot of ways, he must be a product of the system.
I don't remember what we said on that. Do you remember, Kate?
He won a Super Bowl like 50-something percent of the time, which is a lot.
Was that high? No, he couldn't win 50% of the time. He hasn't won 50% of the time in real life.
50% of his career incarnations?
He won a Super Bowl.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not
50%. It's all coming back to me now. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because Belichick, you know, his first year when he was with the Patriots, Drew Bledsoe didn't exactly light the world on fire. And in fact, Brady himself didn't really develop as this sort of Tom Brady, you know, one of the great quarterbacks of all time until around about that 2007 season, if you talk about unprecedented leaps like we were talking about before, Brady himself made a very unprecedented leap from the first half of his career to the second as a passer. I don't know what that says because Belichick was there for both halves of that career, obviously. But it is interesting, you know, Bernie Kosar and people like that had pretty good passing stats, like, you know, top half of the league, sometimes better than that when he was coaching the Browns. And so, I don't know. I do probably tend to lean Belichick because of the reasons you mentioned, Chad, that, you know, you have a lot of sample of games in which Belichick was there and Brady wasn't there, and they were able to pass the ball pretty effectively. And I don't know if you have enough of a sample where you don't have any sample, in fact, where Brady is there but Belichick isn't there, and you can try to zero in on that Belichick question by looking at the Browns. That's basically all you have in one Drew Bledsoe season. That's why, like you said, Kate, it's really tough to disentangle.
Okay, that was not the conversation I wanted about Bill Belichick.
The game was great, though.
But,
good job, Patriots.
But maybe next week we can talk about whether or not this is a more impressive Bill Belichick coaching job than in years past, given the talent that he had available to him.
And we have to, I need Neil to explain to me whether this Patriots defense is actually as good as their stats show, because they've yet to be, they've gotten so lucky and they haven't been tested.
Do you want to do a Super Bowl spectacular next week? All Super Bowl?
Could we?
We can.
All segments.
Can we really
we
get into this Patriots defense? Because they haven't faced the tough teams yet.
Listeners, stay tuned next week. A hot takedown special. Super Bowl LI, the showdown. That's a bad tagline.
Tune in.
Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Tommy John. Modern life is all about the upgrade. Your phone, your operating system, if you're lucky, your flight seat status. And now it is time to upgrade your underwear. Tommy John is a revolutionary men's underwear brand that has redefined comfort for guys everywhere. Each pair is crafted from ultra-lightweight fabric for maximum breathability. It has a patented 21st century design that means the legs of the underwear never ride up and the waistband never rolls down. And they've got a lot more than just ultra-modern underwear. Their undershorts are super soft and never come untucked. And their socks have this thing where they always look like a sock, even when they're not on your foot. That's how firmly structured they are and how nice they are. And all of Tommy John's underwear is backed by a guarantee that if it's not the best pair that you've ever worn, they're going to give it to you for free. So hurry to TommyJohn.com/takedown to get 20% off your first order. That is TommyJohn.com/takedown. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. So a few weeks ago, we talked about a Duke guard, Lexi Brown, who challenged and beat Kate Fagan's college NCAA free throw record.
Sure, she challenged it. She was just making tons of free throws,
right,
and then just happened to pass
me. She didn't
know
she was challenging.
I don't think she was practicing all summer, and she was like, I'm really going to take down that record. But anyway, Chad, please continue.
And you know, we realized as we were talking about that we had to have Lexi Brown come on to talk about what it's like to keep hitting free throws, whether, you know, that starts to play on your mind. Also to talk about what's going on in women's college basketball right now and with the Duke team. And so here she is, Lexi Brown. Lexi, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well, thank you. So we should ask straight off the bat, was there a picture of Kate in your locker that you were just like, staring down as you chased her record?
No, I mean, honestly, I had no idea that I was that close to breaking any type of record. You know, I was just surprised that I was actually getting to the free throw line as much as I had been throughout the season, considering that I had not really been to the free throw line that much my past 2 years playing. So I was just trying to make as many as I could. And then all of a sudden I saw a tweet after one of the games, and it was just like, you're close to this record, you're close to this record. So I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like maybe I'll be able to break it. So, I mean, then of course it popped in my mind for every game. So that was
A
little added pressure.
Your streak finished at 56 straight made free throws. It's an ACC record, sixth all-time in the NCAA. Mm-hmm. Kate, what was your record again? Do we even want to say the number?
It was 44 at the time. I was impressed by myself, but this was like 12 years ago. And Neil and I were having a conversation an hour ago about what – I'm sure he didn't crunch the numbers fast enough – how much more difficult it is to have a streak of 56 versus 44. Like, it's probably easier to get to, like, 30 in a row than it is to get from 44 to 56. Like, that's mm-hmm. a lot longer. Yeah. Neil, did you?
I mean, yeah. I mean, 44 is impressive.
Thank you, Lexi.
I don't want you to beat yourself up about it. I mean, your record was up for 12 years for a reason, so, I mean, that's impressive, definitely.
Lexi, when you were in the middle of your streak, I think it was just when you had passed 44 and Duke Women's Basketball tweeted at me, we did a little bit on this podcast about how I missed my 45th in a row. I mean, obviously it ended at 44, so I missed my 45th. And I tell this story. It was in the NCAA tournament, and the net was actually caught on the rim, but the refs didn't catch it. This is – and I can, like I said, Lexi, I can talk about it this way because it was a long time ago. And so it's like I got the record got stripped out from under me. I would have kept going, but how did you miss?
Blame the net.
That's right. You know how it is. That net is super helpful. But
yeah,
how did you miss your 57th? What happened?
Well, it was we were at NC State. It was just a tough game for everybody. You know, that missed free throw kind of was like the definition of our game at NC State. Like, we were just all out of sorts, like, as a team. I'd missed, it was two-shot free throw. I've made my first one, and the second one just bounced out. And I looked over at the bench, and everyone was just like, no! Like, I think we were, I don't even remember if we were up or down at that moment, but I was just like, oh, man, my streak is over. We're about to lose this game. Like, this is just double negative today. But, you know, now I can just – I went to the locker room after the game. You know, everyone was really, like, hurt after the game. But I got a text from my mom, and she was like, you know, the best part about a streak is you can make a new one. So, I mean, it was – it stunk, of course, that I missed it. And then, of course, we ended up losing that game. But, you know, it's kind of like a little weight off of my shoulders, you know. I mean, everybody wanted to talk about that free throw streak all the time, but hopefully I'll be able to shoot enough for the rest of the season maybe to get close to it again.
You know, as a shooter, that whenever you shoot a free throw or a three-pointer, you know, when you just 98% of the time you know whether it's going in or not the second.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's that occasional time where it bounces directly off the back of the rim and you're just like, wait, how did that happen? Was this free throw one where you thought when it left your hand it was good, or did you feel like you had missed it?
Oh no, I thought it was going in. It literally was one of those that like bounced a couple times and it was like doo-doo-doo out. And I was like, oh.
And my last free throw question here, because I can still take myself through, there's some nostalgia happening here, Lexi. I could still take myself through my entire free throw routine. What is your free throw routine?
Mine is spin the ball in my hands, bounce twice, like right outside of my right foot, and I look down and then I look straight up. And what I look at the rim is the net. It like makes a W or an M, whatever you look at it, right in the front, and that's what I look at.
And so if that net was caught on the rim,
okay,
that would
totally caught on the rim, it would ruin everything. Everything would be ruined.
So, Lexi, I want to talk about Duke this year. Some rankings just from the selection committee just came out from the NCAA selection committee, and you guys are ranked 14th, the women's side of the bracket. There are some regular rankings that are released all the way through the year, almost like what the college football playoff has started to do. And you guys are ranked 14th, a couple ACC teams ahead of you in Florida State and Notre Dame. And so I'm curious, you know, as you think about the stretch that Duke has to play in the next couple months here, or month and a half rather, you know, what's the key for you guys going forward?
Basically just taking one game at a time. We had a rough patch, of course, last week when we dropped two games against Florida State and NC State. We kind of played very out of character and not together as a team. So, you know, we've had a lot of film sessions with Coach and a lot of, you know, individual talks with Coach, I mean, about how everyone needs to play their role and embrace their role. And that's kind of the most important thing looking forward, is everybody embracing their role and everyone playing for each other and not getting too high, not getting too low, and not looking too far ahead on a schedule. You know, Coach P always says the most important game is the one that we're about to play. So, you know, just taking it one day at a time, getting better in practice and pushing each other.
Lexi, I know you guys are looking forward, but just indulge me for a second looking back on the history of Duke women's basketball, because a friend of mine played for Duke in the mid-90s before Duke women's basketball became what it was under Coach G. And then after the mid-90s, obviously, it took off, and there was that national championship game against Maryland and, Abby Wehner. I think she had a turnover. I mean, you know this whole story. And then Christy Tolliver hits the three. There's some element, I think, in women's basketball world of like, was this the start of some sort of curse, right? Because Duke women's basketball has always been in the top five and just unable at certain moments that we talk about here, like unlucky bounces that have happened. Like, as a member of that program, like, how do you play all of that out in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I literally watched like the unlucky bounces just unfold in front of my eyes last year when I was sitting, and I was like, wow, this is really real. Like, I thought it was just people being like dumb about it, but no, like I saw it all happen, like injury, and then the investigation, and I was just like, oh my goodness, like this is ridiculous. But this year, you know, it's like a completely different vibe to the program, and I think that, I mean, I feel like sports is like all about your mental toughness and like the positive energy that you surround your program with. And I just think that we have so much more positive energy in our practices, in our locker room, you know, at our meals. Everything is just so much more positive. And I think everyone is just so happy for each other all the time. Everybody wants to work so hard for each other. We haven't really had to deal with any of those unlucky bounces, knock on wood, yet. And I think if we do, if hopefully we don't, but if we do, I think we'll be able to take it in stride and be able to move forward. But I think that we've grown so much as a team, and I think that this is like going to be one of our breakout seasons. I mean, especially for this freshman group who didn't have the season that I wish that they had last year, and I feel like they're all, you know, about to break out of all their shells, especially Kyra, who I think has been playing awesome this season considering that she struggled a little bit last year. So I've been really proud of Kyra.
Now, Lexi, do you think that this year kind of offers maybe a better opportunity also for your team to advance because, you know, UConn, even though they're in this long streak of winning, they lost a lot of talent from last year. They seem like they might be a little bit less dominant. Is that something that you think about or is that you're just focused on your team and you'll handle the tournament when it comes up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, anything that UConn is doing right now is incredible. I mean, I don't care what kind of sports fan you are. To win that many games in a row is, like, unheard of for any team, which that makes me proud to be part of women's basketball, that you have a team doing something like that, even though sometimes people on the outside are like, it's bad for the sport. I think it's awesome. I mean, if someone wants to finally step up and challenge them, that would be nice, but they haven't yet. So
is that going to be you guys?
Let them do what they do. I mean, I hope so. I mean, I would love to have the opportunity to face that team. You know, they're so talented. You know, Katie Lou has been killing it. Gino, of course, just can coach his butt off, and, you know, you can't take anything away from that team. But, you know, we are a very, like, team that likes to keep stuff internal, and we like to focus on us. And, you know, Coach P always talks about that we're all in a bubble together, and you can't let anybody pop that bubble. So, you know, we just got to keep worrying about what we're doing because I know UConn's not worried about what anybody else is doing. So I think that as long as we, you know, stick together, work hard, you know, if we get that chance, I think that maybe we'll be able to give them a good game, if not beat them.
So, Lexi, we should note, though, that if anyone knows what it's like to have a streak, it's you at this point. And so I wonder, you know, does the free throw streak help you understand the pressure that might be on UConn? Can you exploit that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's all mental. I mean, I feel like free throws are one of the most mental parts of the basketball game. I mean, you have people who shoot a ridiculous amount from the field, but then they get to the free throw line and it's like plummets. And I've never been able to wrap my mind around that, but I mean, it's just mental. What UConn has been able to do has been amazing. And, you know, that's mental toughness, especially since so many people doubted their talent before the season even started. And, you know, but that just shows that a lot of people don't know what kind of coach Gino is, and he pushes his players, you know, and the fact that they play in the conference that they do and still are able, you know, to play as hard as they do and make statements and be top teams is amazing. And I mean, I'm extremely proud of that team, and you know, it'd be cool, you know, to be a part of a team like that, but you know, unfortunately I'm just watching from the side, but you know, it's still really cool to see.
All right, Lexi Brown, the ACC Player of the Week, we should know. Mm-hmm. Lexi Brown, Duke's next game.
Yeah.
Duke's now. Oh, yeah, that little thing.
That's right.
If you want to watch Lexi and the rest of the Blue Devils, it's on Thursday the 26th. They're playing Notre Dame. Big game. Notre Dame's ahead of
always
them.
Always a big game.
In the standings. Lexi,
huge
thanks
game.
Thanks so much for coming on Hot Takedown.
Thank you.
Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. This week, Hot Takedown is sponsored by 1-800-Flowers. Start this year off with a romantic gift from 1-800-Flowers.com. It's going to be the best decision you make this Valentine's season. 1-800-Flowers has great deals on elegant and stunning bouquets. Right now, a vast selection as well of beautiful rose bouquets that are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. All you have to do is pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. Again, those vibrant bouquets start at just $29.99, and there is a 100% smile guarantee. If you or your loved one has any issue, 1-800-Flowers will make it right. So to get beautiful and vibrant rose bouquets starting at just $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com. When you're there, click the radio icon and enter code TAKEDOWN. That's 1-800-Flowers.com. Do not forget, when you're there, to click that radio icon and enter code TAKEDOWN to let them know where you came from. Hurry, this offer ends soon. Before the 76ers lost to the Atlanta Hawks last night, Philadelphia had won 7 of its past 9 games. Those 7 wins are more than half the number of wins they had all of last season. Everything has been clicking over this 9 or 10 game span for the Sixers, in particular Joel Embiid, the rookie center, who is averaging 28 points, 11 rebounds, and 3.4 blocks per 36 minutes. Now, he's not playing 36 minutes, I don't think, quite yet. But I want to talk about the Sixers, whether this is for real in the sense that, not that they're going to go to the playoffs this year or anything, but is...
Well, that's what Embiid says, though.
If they have 4 more stretches, like the one they just had, they'll be about 500.
And that's good enough for the East. But I do want to talk about whether or not a stretch like this in the NBA is indicative of future success when you're the age that the Sixers are, or the aggregate age the Sixers are. Because we've talked about how in baseball any team can win 7 out of 10 games, and, you know, so be it. It doesn't matter whether it doesn't suggest that they're good or bad. But we also say that there's more value in each NBA game to tell us how good an NBA team is than there is in a baseball game. And especially when a team is young, that suggests to me that this is – that maybe the process worked.
And I'm wondering about the value of each NBA game in January as well. Like, when is the easiest time for a mediocre, young, growing team to put a stretch like this together? My guess would be January.
We should note that five of their last 6 games were wins. The Trailblazers, the Raptors, who were good, the Wizards, who are coming up, the Hornets, and the Knicks. So, you know, it's a mixed competition there.
I have thoughts about why I think this stretch is meaningful, but it has very little to do with the actual record that the Sixers posted.
Okay.
Go on.
So, when I was covering the Sixers and Hinkie was just in conversations about whether he would take over as GM, I remember him saying very specifically that the absolute hardest thing to do in the NBA is to get your first star, to get a star. Because once you have one star, it becomes slightly easier to get a second star, and then even easier to get that third star. And so for the Sixers right now, it's less about the record than the content of the games within the record, because I think we're leaning more and more towards saying that Embiid is that player, where that foundational piece. And so every win now actually means like it's growing towards something rather than a win that's in this wasteland that we don't know yet what we want to do with the Sixers. I mean, this is a franchise that traded Michael Carter Williams after being Rookie of the Year because he wasn't a foundational enough piece to actually say this is our number one star.
In retrospect, probably a good decision.
And a good decision. And so for me, it matters because I do believe that Embiid is a guy that you can say now, okay, what is our next piece that we think complements him and we can build around him? Because I think what we've seen from him this year is enough to say, now, okay, here's your guy. It took him 10 years after trading Iverson to the Nuggets to say, now we have a guy.
And what's also complicating for the Sixers is that Nerlens Noel, can the two of them coexist and be two guys?
And that's where I'm...
And is Ben Simmons the third guy? And all of a sudden, then you don't need the free agent. The normal model of attracting them.
Well, sure, that was the whole premise.
And where does Okafor go?
Right. So, but my question, I guess, we talked about Sam Hinkie in the process before and this question of whether or not that was wise because you're shooting for foundational excellence as opposed to iterative excellence, essentially, through free agency. Do the last 10 games change our thoughts on the process, A, because now some returns are finally coming in, and B, to your point, Kate, you know, what's the next step for the Sixers, I guess? It sounds like where you're headed.
Yeah, and first I want to know if, like, my gaze at Embiid is verified in the numbers, that the numbers he's putting up are leading us to believe that has he been doing it long enough at this point to say, okay, yeah, he's the guy we can build around going forward, and we don't need to keep testing every single player we have?
I mean, yeah, for a player at his particular age, which is 22 this season, to have the type of season that he has had just in the limited time that he's had, because, you know, he's missed a number of games, but, you know, you don't see a 22-year-old big man put up a number. We use box plus minus here at 538, which is kind of a synthesis of how much a player adds to his team when he's on the court per 100 possessions. And according to Basketball Reference, Embiid is a plus 3.7 player. That's a player that adds 3.7 points of point differential per 100 possessions. That's a player that the Sixers haven't really had in a while. They haven't had someone that's capable of that. And also, 22-year-old big men don't have seasons like that in general. If you go back throughout the history of the NBA, at least going back to the merger, because that's when you can calculate this particular stat, you get players at age 22, big men, that did this, like Kevin Love, Tyson Chandler. You know, those are the two big ones that had 3.7 BPM at that age. People who are a little bit higher, of course, Giannis this year is a plus 9.2, so that kind of blows a lot of things out of the water. But, you know, you don't find guys as big men that were necessarily higher than that. Like Blake Griffin was higher than that at the same age, if we want to call him. You know, they're obviously different types of players. But a lot of times the guys that are doing this at this age are young, you know, guards or wings, like Chris Paul, LeBron James, Derrick Rose, Kawhi Leonard, Russell Westbrook, Paul George. These are people. Dirk Nowitzki might be considered a big.
Those are all names that I think is fair to now say from the Sixers' point of view.
So he was worse than those guys, but he's in the same neighborhood. Well, I mean, the fact that he's in the neighborhood and better than people like Chris Bosh, Greg Monroe. You know, people have talked about Greg Monroe as being sort of like this foundational star. It's kind of dimmed a little bit in recent years. But as recently as a few years ago, Anthony Davis, he had a down year last year. His down year was significantly worse than Joel Embiid's season at age 22, which is, by the way, the only piece of evidence we have about Joel Embiid as an NBA player at this point. Also, Dwight Howard wasn't this good at the same age. Steven Adams not good as good. Pau Gasol. So if you're looking at big men at this age, Embiid sort of is rising to the top of any kind of historical rankings. Now, having said that, it is in a sample of, you know, not as many minutes as you would expect. It's 758 minutes right now. So he probably needs to keep it up. And certainly the way he's been playing in that streak that you're talking about, Chad, is even higher than that 3.7 mark. So, I am a Embiid believer. Embleeder? Nah, I got nothing. Anyway.
Embleefer.
Yeah, Embleefer. I like it. Yeah, I'm wondering from the Sixers' point of view now, when you look at a 750-minute sample size, where you go from here. To me, they're at the place where they're like, we want to like somewhat place Embiid at the center of everything, but still need a season. I mean, because they don't need to worry about the playoffs to say, can he solidify himself there? And then what happens with – because they've only played 8 minutes together, right? Noel and Embiid. I mean, can the Sixers create a new model where they're like, we're going to have two dominant big men and they can play together? Or are they going to have to trade – some asset to go with the current traditional model in the NBA?
I definitely think Okafor would be the one that might, just looking at it statistically, you would want to be the odd man out in that if you could get any kind of trade value for him, because, you know, for Embiid working out, I think, as well as people thought he or had hoped he would. And even Noel, you know, for all the criticism and the trade rumors and all the injuries and things like that, when he has played, he's actually been pretty good. Most of that, in fact, almost all of that value has been on defense. But he seems like a kind of player that could complement Embiid, because Embiid, you know, is not really like the pieces do seem to interlock. Noel is a defensive-minded big man that you could play next to a kind of offensive scoring-minded guy like Embiid, who can actually pass the ball once in a while. And so, you know, those two seem like they would fit. Okafor might be the odd man out. It should also be said some of the other guys that came in the process, like Dario Saric, has been terrible, just flat out terrible this year. And so, you know, it's been a mixed bag, and I think you do still need to hit on the model that Hinkie was going for was obviously the Oklahoma City Thunder model of 5, 6, 7 years ago, the Seattle Supersonics model. And they ended up hitting on all of the guys. Like, you ended up getting Durant and Westbrook and Ibaka and
Harden
and all of these guys. It was really a remarkable string of home runs that they hit on draft picks, where you really can't expect to hit home runs on all of them. And it looks like for a while it looked like the Sixers would have struck out on every single one. And now with Embiid emerging and, you know, whatever you end up doing with Noel, I don't know, that you've at least hit something, approach it, maybe a double on, you know, on some of them. And so I think for that model to work out still, though, you still need to have either in subsequent drafts be able to get someone who ends up being a star, near star, or have some of these guys who have underperformed so far with the picks that Hinkie made during the process phase turn things around and actually become good players.
And perhaps
stars.
Ben Simmons is that
and Simmons
second
is the wild card, right?
It seems to me that what we've seen from the Sixers in terms of some draft picks being busts, some playing well, and then you get assets for like Michael Carter Williams or Embiid perhaps being the foundational star for them, is pretty much reflective of like every team that operates in this sphere of like some things work out, some don't.
Right.
Whereas Oklahoma City, Seattle is the outlier, and then Sixers of 2 years ago seeming to bust on everything also being the outlier. But what the Sixers have more than any other is like the lottery tickets. So to me, that's where Hinkie is like having knew that the Oklahoma City, Seattle Supersonics model was one where they got so much return on investment, and he knew he needed more lottery tickets. So I know I don't want, it's not like a Hinkie debate here, but the Sixers at this point to me is like they're operating, they're totally reflective of the NBA, except that they have more options on the table.
Right, in subsequent drafts.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think sitting from where the Sixers were at the beginning of Hinkie's time, having things turn out the way they kind of are right now, you probably would have been like the mean expectation, or maybe just a little bit below, but, you know, pretty much what a reasonable person could have expected things to have.
So Sam Hinkie has cause to sue for wrongful termination.
Well, no, because, I mean, I think so much, like, we can say that the Oklahoma City model was above and beyond the type of luck that you could expect. But I think a lot of these, like, multi-year tanking exhibitions are kind of predicated on the premise of trying to luck into that Oklahoma City thing, right? Like buying all these lottery tickets, knowing that the median expectation is a certain amount of success. And the median expectation might just be to end up as a 500 team, you know, 5 to 10 years down the road. Like you'll, like you said, Kate, you'll hit on some, you'll strike out on others. And at the end of the day, if you don't get that star or you don't get enough really quality cornerstone players, you end up as kind of an okay team. And that's not at all what the goal was kind of stated. Like this was explicitly a mission trying to hit that, you know, best case scenario.
But, well, it was a mission to bring the Sixers out of mediocrity, because
right,
they were
exactly
in mediocrity.
Right, that's right, where they were when they
so
started.
So to
right
say that the goal was to be mediocre, I hope not.
No, it wasn't. Right.
But Neil, I take issue, though, because just because you might, there's a 50-50 chance, the average, let's say, is to end 500,
right,
doesn't necessarily mean that the best, that does, is not the best way to win 75% of your games, right?
Right.
So, like, the question isn't what's the average outcome. The question is, what's the best process to reach the best outcome.
And also, what are the extreme outcomes that could happen on the basis of it? And if you kind of operate like a normal NBA team, your median outcome is a 500 team. But also, you have less possibility of being really bad and also less possibility of being really good.
Because most NBA teams operate with a game plan where it's like there's a 90% chance that they're solid, mediocre. Right. And there's small chances they're terrible, small chance they're great. I think the Sixers are operating in, like you said, like a wider berth of there is a chance they're going to be mediocre, but there's a higher chance they're going to be great and a higher chance they're going to be absolutely terrible.
Right, yeah.
No, I think we're all on the same page there. Yeah. And so I guess the next question is whether or not this particular burst and a lot of the other stuff with Simmons coming back and subsequent draft picks can kind of push them more toward that extreme good outcome.
I'm of the irrational belief that the Sixers are going to be amazing in 2 years just because that storyline is irrefutable. And history and the universe wants to deliver us this storyline.
Well, and the fact that they are now at that point of kind of like middle contention means maybe they have come out of and avoided that like truly terrible outcome finally after, you know, 5 years or however
long
it's been.
And Chad's going to like go for it. I don't have anything else.
I'm just saying we got to try and get Hinkie on the show.
I think that's a realistic possibility.
Yeah. All right. So, Sam, if you're out there, we're ready.
You listen to like 12 podcasts a week. Can this be one of them?
We're not asking for too much. All right. Let's leave it there. And move on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us. So we went through a lot of different possibilities this week. What we will bring you is $4,045. That's the amount of money that the Fish Guy Mover Services, which is a service that moves fish, said that they were owed by Brandon Spikes, the Buffalo linebacker, after Spikes did not pay for his fish moving. They didn't pay. Spike says he didn't pay because one of the fish died. This is coming up now, even though it happened 2 years ago, because apparently Spike's wages were garnished this year because of this fish removal.
First NFL player ever to have wages garnished over a fish controversy.
I'm assuming in the contract that he signed, it said, like, we're not accountable if for reasons outside of our control, your fish dies while we're moving it. Though the counterpoint
to that.
I don't know
the circumstances of the fish.
The counterpoint to that is, like, if you're a fish moving company, to me, the most tenuous part of moving a fish is keeping it alive.
Right.
Like, that's the part that you are there for, is fish are hard to move and they require water and therefore you are promising to deliver them alive.
Yeah, anybody could kill the fish and then transport them.
Right.
We should note that Spikes, as of last week, still owed the fish guy over $3,000, but a judge has ruled that the collection can be halted for now. So Spikes is really trying to hang on to that $3,000. Here's my...
It's on principle, Chad.
Okay, so that was my question. If you're an athlete, I'm sure you're used to people trying to bilk you in all sorts of ways. And so I think even more important that you stick to your principle and try and save $3,000, even if $3,000 doesn't mean that much to you, especially when you're grieving over the fish that died in the process.
And also when you're in the NFL, unless you're like a big superstar, like $3,000 still actually is a decent amount of money. If you're only making after taxes like a couple hundred grand, I know that's a ton of money, but I would still want my $3,000. And also, because I just completed a move in which they forgot two boxes and just lost them. Like, am I supposed to pay?
How many animals were inside?
Yeah.
No animals, but like, you know, furniture and things I wanted. Am I supposed to pay for the full move when you actually didn't complete the full move?
That's a fine question.
These are tough questions.
These are tough
movers.
Existential questions.
What'd you do?
We're in the process of trying to decide whether they can find the boxes, whether they're going to refund us some of the move, because the boxes were, you know, worth a couple grand. Not the boxes, the contents of the boxes.
The fish
inside
the boxes.
So I understand Spikes' conundrum, and add on top of that, that there was life involved.
Yes. I just think that this is guaranteed to stand out as the biggest fish-based NFL controversy until a Troy McClure-style situation comes up in the NFL. If you remember The Simpsons, there was a scandal involving Troy McClure and a fish, and he had a bumper sticker that said, "Follow me to Springfield Aquarium." So,
listeners, you've just learned the only thing that Neil knows better than sports, which is random
moments in Simpsons
history. All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Guys, I don't have the usual bullet list rundown in front of me, but I think I can do it from memory.
You're flying blind, Chad.
I'm locked out of my Google account, and so here we go. Neil, thanks for talking about sports with me.
Thanks, Chad.
Kate Fagan, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Chad.
Our producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast fishman is Jody Avergan. Our intern is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Jorge Estrada and Tony Chow. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, leave a review. It helps others discover the program.
Our theme song
is by Mystery Mansion.
And you are
Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.